From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we remember a golfing legend.
Champion, architect, ambassador, mentor, role model, icon, legend, the king. There's a lot of names that describe Arnold Palmer.
How Arnold Palmer changed the game and Georgia forever, and also a conversation with two Olympic icons, Tommy Smith and John Carlos. That's coming up. First, though, Friday, the Break Room Gang wondered if handwriting is a dying art, as author Anne Trebek claims.
Focus on how to teach children how to express their ideas, how to organize their thoughts, how to make arguments, you know, the content of the writing, the forming of the letters is less important. And there's certainly many ways to individualize what you write beyond having, you know, the way you circle the I or cross your T.
Here are your first thoughts. Michael Ruffin tweets, I write in my prayer journal by hand. Everything else is by keyboard. Only God can read my handwriting. Philly Kaplan adds, I love handwriting. Most thank you notes and birthday cards are in cursive and calligraphy even. I find it very relaxing. And Terry Anulowitz, I don't know if I'm butchering that name, Terry, says, don't despair. I have two grade schoolers and big birthday party hit with their friends is a multicolor pack of Sharpies or gel pens. So we always love to know if you handwrite things or anything else that you think. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or find us on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Election Day is just about a month away. Today and tomorrow, we'll speak with the top candidates in the race for U.S. Senate here in Georgia. Up first is businessman and Democratic candidate Jim Barksdale, and he faces an uphill climb in his effort to unseat incumbent Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson. Polls show Isaacson will win a third term, but polls are what they are. Barksdale's campaign would have to overcome a double-digit deficit to win, but if he does, it could help upset the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. And businessman Jim Barksdale joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Celeste. Glad to be here.
So you have characterized this race as between an outsider and an insider. Are you just talking about Isaacson's long tenure in the Senate?
No, it's more than the tenure. It's really the policies that have been so reckless and dangerous for Americans, particularly economically, that to a certain extent both parties have bought into. But certainly Johnny Isaacson represents that, both following what I believe is a false ideology of trickle-down economics, that if you just get out of the way of business, that everybody's incomes will rise, and that hasn't proven to be true. And that's been further enabled by really a degree of corruption that comes from big money writing all the policies and bills so that corporations make more money. But it's been very detrimental to wages and worker incomes and job opportunities. So working Americans have been harmed while big corporations have profited. And this is all part of the false ideology of trickle-down economics.
Now, to a certain extent, some of the things that you and, say, a Bernie Sanders describes as corruption is kind of the way politics is done in the U.S. How would you avoid that system of lobbyists and money and corporate donors if you were in the Senate?
Well, certainly Citizens United is something that we need to overturn and get rid of, and that's the first
law
job.
That said that corporations are people and have
people
a voice.
Yeah. And have unlimited amounts of money and dark pools of money that have had such a influence on our elections where people don't really know what the agendas are of the big money that's coming into various races. And of course, I think there's a lot more that can be done in terms of getting a better balance with respect to money. It's true that there has always been a valid voice for the people who have money and capital and businesses on the line in politics. I'm not arguing that there should not be a voice. What I'm arguing is that the balance has been upset and that the voice of the people has been not present at the table, and that the bills keep getting written to benefit large corporations and to harm that have harmed American workers. The trade bills are just part of that. We can also see the deregulation of Wall Street that took the economy off the cliff. This probably increased our debt by $2 to $4 trillion. I don't know. It depends on how you do the math. But trillions of dollars of debt came from a very poor economy.
You mean the bailout that contributed to
it? Well, it was the recession that came from casino economics, where the Bush administration said, we can just leave Wall Street alone. and we don't have to regulate it very much. But the protections that were put in place in the 1930s were put in there because they knew that Wall Street needed and the savers needed protection. But those were removed in 1999 and 2000. Both parties were guilty, but that was followed up by a lax enforcement of the banking system and real estate lending, and that's what led the economy off the cliff.
Now,
and these are big donors that benefited Wall Street.
A number of high-profile Georgia Democrats have endorsed your Republican opponent, the incumbent Johnny Isakson. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's fewer that have, quote-unquote, endorsed him as opposed to have made contributions to him. The contributions really are, these are very, very long-time ties of personal relationships that go back to college days. And I can't fault people for having personal relationships that have lasted that long.
So you're an investment manager and a successful one, and yet you have said that capitalism doesn't work very well. What does that mean?
That's a complete misquote that I think the press should be ashamed for carrying on. Because what I said was that when income inequality reaches the levels of today, in a way that it reached the levels in the 20s, that we saw that the mechanism of how capitalism creates jobs fails. I am in capital. I've been investing.
Yeah, you're a very successful
absolutely.
Capitalist.
Absolutely, I believe in capitalism. So that's a complete misquote. And what I'm saying is that when all the income is going to the top 1% or even less, when all the money and wages are declining for working Americans, you cannot have an economy that grows when wages are declining. So this is where
that sounds like you're saying we have to reduce income inequality in order for capitalism to work.
We have lived through these periods before, and this was what happened in the 20s, where all the income was going to the big trust and the big corporations at the time. And as Will Rogers said, we were so capable at mass production that we had mass produced ourselves out of jobs. And this is what brought on the Great Depression. You have to have some distribution of that income so that the workers share in the productivity that has been obtained both by trade and by technology. All the gains from productivity have been going to the large corporations. And part of that is because all the bills get written to benefit large corporations.
So, I mean, there is a value in someone having a long tenure in the Senate, because as you become a senior senator, it gives you a little more power on Capitol Hill. Let's say that you were elected. What do you foresee as some of your challenges as a rookie senator?
Well, I think the problem when you have been in the Senate for a long time and you have more power is that if you're following reckless and dangerous policies, it just is more harmful to us. And I think that's my problem with what Senator Isakson, his situation is that he has been following very false ideologies, both with respect to trickle-down economics, and he doubles down with it. He continues to say that he wants to privatize Social Security. And he, on his first speech on the Senate floor, when he was a rookie, the first thing he did was defend George Bush's actions in Iraq and George Bush's desires to privatize Social Security. Both of those have been terrible. Those would be terrible ideas. The Iraq war has cost us $3 to $4 trillion. And just to put that in perspective, the entire trust fund that has been accumulated in Social Security by all the savings of all Americans since 1930s is about $3.7 trillion. That is how much was squandered by the reckless decision to go into Iraq.
Well, since you've brought up foreign policy, I mean, the U.S. Senate also weighs in on a lot of international issues. Do you feel that you're prepared to weigh in on issues of, say, Johnny Isakson was just here at GPB last week, and he was talking about the situation in Ukraine, for example. He was talking about the situation related to Brexit. Do you feel as though do I have a preparation that you need?
Well, clearly I'm more prepared than Senator Isakson, because I was opposed to the Iraq war because of the unnecessary aspect of it, and the clear sense that this was going to wreak havoc in the Middle East, and yet he was for it. So he was unprepared. Likewise, the idea that we're going to now invoke Article 5 within NATO to go defend a non-NATO member. I mean, Article 5 is the collective defense.
Right.
If we're attacked, then if one is attacked, everyone feels
right.
attacked.
And when he was speaking with Bill Nigut, he said that NATO members should go and defend Ukraine against
right.
Russia's advances.
Right. And the only time since in the history of NATO when Article 5 has been invoked was when the U.S. was attacked on 9/11. But now he is suggesting that when Ukraine, a non-member of NATO, is involved with the Crimea and Russia, that we should invoke Article 5, send troops in to basically get into a hot war with Russia. This is part of what I said, the false ideology that Senator Isaacson, I think, puts forward is this idea of American primacy all over the world, that we've bellicosity, that we have got to go and take on every country and put troops on the ground. In the same interview, he put forward the idea that we needed to put ground troops in Syria. So he hasn't learned the lessons of Iraq, that when we go into these situations and we risk not only the lives of our sons and daughters, but trillions of dollars and don't have an exit strategy, or we don't understand the implications of having our presence in foreign lands, this, I think, is, again, reckless policies. And that's what I'm so concerned about, that the policies have been placing America in jeopardy, both economically and from a military security standpoint.
So you are at this point have double digits behind Senator Isaacson in the polls. How can you bring that around within a month's time or so?
Well, the polls that we see have it closer. There's a lot of undecideds out there, and we need to be getting out and having my name recognition increased. That's why I appreciate these interviews. People, frankly, don't know me. I think as they get to know me and they hear that there is a clear choice, do you want more of the same old politics as usual that Isaacson represents, which is basically obstructionism of the president, which we've seen ever since Senator McConnell said they were going to do everything to stop Obama to being elected, all the way to currently refusing to have a hearing on Merrick Garland.
The nominee for the Supreme Court.
More obstructionism politics, that's what you get with Senator Isaacson. More false economics in terms of a boom-bust cycle of trickle-down. Income inequality that I spoke about, this is what creates the boom-bust cycles of the 30s, and it's what we've seen in 2008 and 9. It's what we saw in 2001, too, when the stock market fell. And frankly, we're living on another bubble right now that the monetary authorities are just printing money. And with Senator Isaacson, you just get more and more wars, unending wars that are bankrupting us. I think it's time people want to see us investing in America. People have been waiting in line to get their slice of the American dream. But we haven't been investing in here in this country. We've been engaged in wars for 15 years, and they've done nothing for us. And think about the parents of these children. I opposed the war because at the time my son was 13 years old. And I asked myself, would I send my son into that war? And the answer was no.
That is Jim Barksdale, businessman running for the U.S. Senate here in Georgia. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we speak with Barksdale's opponent, Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Two Georgia residents were honored by President Obama last week. The pair are former Olympians who medaled in the 1968 Games in Mexico City.
In the center of the field is Tommy Smith running through. President Peter Norman runs a play. Smith, full muscle and all, couldn't have pulled it that badly. He beat John Carlos.
Tommy Smith took home the gold in the 200-meter dash while John Carlos clinched the bronze. But what happened on the awards podium was an even bigger headline. Smith and Carlos raised their gloved fists in a Black Power salute, and the reaction was both swift and widespread.
Good morning to you. The Olympic Games are 1 week old today, and yesterday, the sixth day, was the most dramatic so far. It started with the news that the Black Power disciples Tommy Smith and John Carlos the Olympic 200 meters gold and bronze medalists had been suspended by the United States Olympic Committee and given 48 hours to leave Mexico.
Former Olympic athlete Tommy Smith joins us now to talk about that iconic moment and being acknowledged by the president. Welcome.
Good morning to you.
But we did speak with John Carlos as well, and I wanted to actually play a comment to get our conversation started from John Carlos. And I asked him about higher paid athletes like Serena Williams becoming more politically active, and then some cautioning that, say, for example, Serena could hurt her career and hurt her earnings if she starts speaking out on political issues. And here's what John Carlos said about that.
It's not about the money. That's what Mr. Kaepernick is saying right now. You know, when I made my statement 48 years ago, I had $13 in my bank account. This young man had $13 million in his account. He's showing the rest of the athletes, this is not about how much money you have or how much money you don't have. You know, Serena, I'm sure she will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. I'm sure Mr. Kaepernick will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. If they feel that, you know, that they're going to move her away from endorsements because she chose to stand up for what's right in society, I don't need those products anyway, if that's the attitude those individuals have, because it makes me think maybe behind closed doors, those sponsors might have a different view about how society should be run.
So let me ask you about that, Tommy Smith. Did it run through your mind at all how your message in back in 1968 might affect your career, your earnings, your future?
Well, you know, it depends on the individual. John Carlos was talking about it depends on the individual how one might view any type of involvement such as this. It also has a lot to do with gender and the involvement on and the succession in society. You know, we had no money back then, and we decided to do this because it was a needed thing to do, and we did it from a college perspective and not a financial perspective. I had no career. I had no education. My sacrifice was a little bit different than both people who have money. One can view it as I have my money, therefore I can do anything I want to. Another aspect could be I have my money and I want to give a decision to the listeners or to the hearers or to the seers or to the doers that it doesn't matter how much money I have. It's from the soul and not from the financial standpoint or financial banking system. So it depends on the individual. You can't take a Serena and put her in the same category as Tommy Smith. You can't take Kaepernick and put him in the same category as John Carlos. These are individual moves that the participant have. So don't put me in the same package as you put someone else who does the same thing. We have different ideas about what we're doing. As long as it's nonviolent, as long as it pertains to the system, as long as it pertains to inequality or policing and nonviolent change, I think the conversation should be around what one think about it themselves and not categorize it with a group of people who are doing something very similar.
Now, the Kaepernick we're referring to is San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He continues his protest. He continues to kneel during the national anthem before games. And he told reporters his purpose is to bring greater attention to the issue of police violence and social injustice.
There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
So without putting the both of you in the same category, Tommy, there is a similarity to the symbolism of your action and then that of Colin Kaepernick. Yours was on a world stage. Yeah. So when something is a symbolic gesture, what is the effectiveness of this? How effective can a gesture like that be?
Well, if you get the ball across the plate, you can throw a 98-mile-an-hour ball, you can throw a 65-mile-an-hour ball, as long as it's going toward the same point of concern. That I can understand. But in '68, we had a platform. of South Africa, Rhodesia, more coaches, more African American or coaches of color hired, housing. We had things that were identifying to the college campus and the human rights issue. So we had two different things going at the same time, and people understood that by us being black athletes, Americans, and the human rights issue. Yes, we were both throwing the ball toward the plate, but they differed. They had both had different speeds because of where we were in society, what platform we took, etc. Serena would be in a different category, and depending on what she stood or what she wouldn't do because of how she believed, it's a sociological point that one must keep as straight as possible and identify what they're trying to do, not doing it because someone else is doing it. And I don't believe the athletes who are doing with Colin is doing it because they're trying to back him. They're doing it because what he's doing, they also agree with. It's the point.
So here is President Obama welcoming you and John Carlos to the White House for a ceremony with this year's Olympic athletes. So here is the president speaking to both of you.
I want to, as a consequence, take a minute to thank some people who paved the way to create that sense that we're in this together. We're honored to have here the legendary Tommy Smith and John Carlos here today. We're honored. I'm proud of them. You know, their powerful silent protest in the 1968 Games was controversial, but it woke folks up and created greater opportunity for those that followed.
So it's been nearly a half a century.
Yeah, it has.
What do you think took so long?
Well, changing of the staff. You had Avery Brundage, Douglas Roby back then doing all the necessary political work for the USOC, also the IOC then, both Americans, and the silent protest. You know, these things that I'm talking about now, the silent protests, they were very well organized, and they started long before that day in Mexico City. So we did have a platform. It was a silent protest. So people viewed that protest as a protest for equality, for justice, and they spoke in their own words. We didn't speak for them. Colin is speaking for him, and others are understanding that. But Tommy Smith, John Carlos stood physically, and they were viewed. Sometime a picture means more than a thousand words, and we were like a picture. So we were hung in walls of campus students and student athletes because they identified that they identified themselves with that picture and their problems. I said earlier that each individual, no matter what problem he or she has, must explain what they're doing and why they're doing it. John Carlos and Tommy Smith stood. That explanation was coming from others of how they felt about that particular platform. Again, a sociological view of a need to stand for something.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Olympic athlete Tommy Smith, who won the gold medal in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. He now lives in Georgia and was honored last week at the White House, both he and fellow athlete John Carlos. So we got this tweet from a listener in terms of the question whether activism belongs in sports. Question, where does activism belong? Bart tweets, answer, nowhere. So it has to belong exactly where it doesn't belong. That's what makes it activism. And this is something that I brought up with John Carlos as well, in response to the people who say Colin Kaepernick is an athlete and he needs to focus on his sport and quit making political statements. Here's what John Carlos said.
John, that's a stupid statement. That's a stupid statement. That's the same stupid-ass statement that they made 48 years ago. How do you tell an individual that you are suspended from society because you're an athlete? That you shouldn't have any concerns about the well-being of those individuals that you grew up with in your community. That's like telling a minister he's not supposed to go to church on Sunday.
So how do you feel about this particular issue? Those who are saying Colin Kaepernick's being paid for a job and kneeling during the national anthem or making a political protest is not part of that job.
Let's continue where John left off. I think it's a comment the individual called in is just as bad as the decision the 1968 that the president of the IOC made about John Carlos and Tommy Smith, saying saying that movements like Carlos and Smith has no place in the Olympic movement. But in 1936, he was in justice or in favor of being ruled or moved like the SS of Hitler. I think people in any position, even Colin Kaepernick, has a right to voice his opinion in this particular flow of life. Now, it's hard because some people, just like I did a few minutes ago, stumble over a need to identify specifically. There's no specifics about what Colin Kaepernick has or have not delved in before he did this. Yes, he has a concern. He used the only platform that he knew how, or the only platform that he had was to voice his opinion. You know, that wasn't the first time Colin didn't stand for the national anthem. He did this. He would recognize this one time, and it exploded
from there.
Yeah,
the first time someone noticed.
Yeah, before someone noticed. So it's an ideal cause for him to do what he did, and I think anyone who says that play your sports and let everything else go, they take the humanistic point out of that person's life.
Do you feel as though your protest ended up impacting your future and your career? Do you think it changed the course of your life?
Well, I had not lived that life before, so I can only say that what I viewed, I believe it had a tendency to make people view me negatively because it had never been done before. And the ideal cause of why it was done was the same reason those people decided to call in and refute the physical movement that John Carlos and Tommy Smith had, because they knew either. Status quo is always safe to live in, because the only place you're going to hurt is what you're sitting on. We move in an optimistic position, nonviolently, to make a change in what we were standing for. We had a reason to stand because we pointed the reason out. Then we said nothing about the reason because we had already spoken what we were trying to do an entire year before. How do you think that the athletes on that team knew the need for us to do what we did? Each athlete, and it was decided by this before we got to Mexico, that each athlete would represent himself according to how he felt the country represented them. So it was nonviolent, and each athlete had a part in playing with how he believed.
So let me play you one more comment that your former colleague John Carlos said. And this is when I was asking about whether or not athletes, because of their position, are obliged to stand up for what they think is injustice. And here was his response.
How you trying to do when they have obligation, when they can wait until their mama get hit across the head or get killed because they came to the wrong house? You darn tootin' they have obligation. You know, and for individuals such as Shaq and Jerry Rice changed his mind. But I see all of the naysayers out there. And the question is, down the line, how are they going to come out in history? Which side of the road are they going to be classified on that day?
What do you think about that, whether or not athletes are obliged to use the position they've been given to speak out?
It's their position. They fought for that position. They can do what they feel is necessary while they're in that position. And I do think it's a necessity for athletes, especially athletes, who have a world stage to proactively move in a direction to make a nation stronger. There are those who say what we did is freedom enough. I don't believe freedom comes in what other people say about what I just did. I, constitutionally speaking, that's where the freedom is, and it is written. And if one doesn't get it, it is written in the Constitution to say one must lobby to change it. So the athletes are in a position to change the eyes of young folks who are coming up. They need a platform. And this is a nonviolent platform. They can talk all they want, but they must have a plan to explain what they mean about what they do. And, of course, anytime you go against status quo, there's going to be different nonviolent attitudes toward what one does. And no malicious intent, nonviolence is the answer, and whether it's directly or indirectly. Consequences, yes, they must be understood, must have a plan to explain, and follow up with verbal explanation. Nonviolence is the finality of explanation. Period. Sad.
Former Olympic athlete Tommy Smith, he won the gold medal in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, now lives in Georgia. He and fellow athlete John Carlos were honored last week at the White House for their now iconic moment of lifting their fists during the podium ceremony. Tommy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Legendary golfer Arnold Palmer passed away at the age of 87 last week. He'll be honored at a public memorial service in his native Pennsylvania tomorrow. There, Palmer is a larger-than-life hero. But his presence in Georgia was huge as well. Four of the seven major championships he won in his career happened in Augusta at the Masters Tournament. And it was at the Masters that Arnold Palmer helped develop a new role for athletes in America, and that is sports celebrity. Sports writer Scott Michaud of the Augusta Chronicle wrote about this in a recent article, and he joins us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Celeste.
You know, one of the things I keep hearing over and over as people describe Arnold Palmer is they often refer to him as the son of a groundskeeper. Why was that particularly significant for Arnold Palmer?
What's significant about it is it made him sort of a player for the people. He wasn't the son of a country club member. He didn't grow up as a member at a club. He grew up working on the staff, and he grew up on the property and being around golf, but not being in golf as we know it as a country club sport. So it's a big deal for the average golf fan. It brought in a whole new level of golf fan to watch this sport because he was felt like he was one of them. He wasn't somebody else.
So I want to ask you what made Arnold Palmer so different from other successful golfers, but let's hear this comment first from ESPN personality Tony Kornheiser. He's talking about Palmer's legacy.
I think he's Babe Ruth. I think he's the most important person in his sports. You could argue very easily that Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods are more accomplished in terms of golf. And even you could look at Tiger Woods with the amount of people he has brought into golf and say that he has elevated golf in ways that other people haven't, but not as much as Palmer.
Would you agree with that? And what does that mean, that Arnold Palmer elevated golf more than others?
Well, Arnold Palmer is, you can quantify that he's not the greatest golfer who ever lived. Jack won many more majors. Sam Snead won more tournaments. So many golfers have been put on a higher pedestal in terms of their accomplishments in the game. But what Arnold did was he made golf into what it is today. Before Arnold came along, I mean, golf was not on television. He shows up at Augusta National and wins the Masters. And it's on television, and he was a magnetic personality. People were drawn to him. There was something about him that was different. While he might not have been the greatest, he was always the most beloved golfer out there. And that changed golf forever. I mean, it made people look at it differently. It made people want to watch television because you wanted to see what he was going to do. He won spectacularly, and he lost spectacularly, and he was so emotive out there on the golf course when he did it. Everything was on his sleeves. You never knew, that what Arnold Palmer you always knew what Arnold Palmer was thinking. He never hid anything. So I think people were drawn to that, and it made golf into a spectacle that it had never been before.
Okay, so let's hear this comment from CBS broadcaster Jim Nance, remembering Palmer during his life after retirement.
His golf career's been over for a long time, and it'll always live on as a legendary career. But Arnold Palmer, the man, and how you treat people, that will live forever.
And Scott, this is something that you have written about, not only internationally, but it's specifically in how Arnold Palmer, the man, and the way he behaved changed the Masters and changed Augusta. What does that mean?
Well, he had a special quality about him in that Arnold would go around, he would hear people talk and say things to him, and he would acknowledge that. He would sign every autograph, and he would sign it with a perfect signature. I mean, maybe the greatest signature since John Hancock. the most recognizable. He always felt that it was important to represent yourself in a way that people could identify with. But he also did it in a mannerly fashion. He's the one who teaches everybody to take your hat off when you go into a clubhouse. He's the one who just sort of did everything the right way, and people appreciated that out of him. And he was just a special character in that sense. And he also didn't play favorites. So he hung out with presidents and celebrities, but he was also great to reporters and people at small town newspapers and big city newspapers alike. He did not differentiate. And that's what made him such a special character in the media and so beloved by the media that when he exited the U.S. Open stage at Oakmont in 1994, and he couldn't even speak, he couldn't get the words out because he was so emotional, that he got a standing ovation from everybody in the room. And you don't see that very often.
My guest is sports writer Scott Michaud. We're talking about the life and career of golfer Arnold Palmer, who died last week. So, Scott, you had opportunities to interview him.
I did, and on many occasions. We used to go down to Bay Hill every year as we prepared for the Masters, and it was funny whenever, somebody from the Augusta Chronicle, my colleague David Weston, who had been covering that tournament for 30 years, whenever we showed up, Arnie treated us like we were family because Augusta was a very important place for him. He was not only a four-time Masters champion, but he was also the first pro to become a member at the club there. So he was always very good to us and treated us well and would give you stories that he wouldn't give anybody else sometimes. And you always appreciate that out of somebody.
And Bay Hill is the private golf resort near Orlando where they host the Arnold Palmer Invitational. That when you say Bay Hill, that people outside of golf may not understand what that refers to. One of the things that you also write about is his life as a sports celebrity. And we have to think back to the age in which Arnold Palmer retired. And there weren't a whole lot of sports celebrities, but he probably far exceeded his earnings from golf during his time. I guess on ads and celebrity appearances. Here's one of his many commercial endorsements. It's a Pennzoil ad from the 1970s.
Nobody has to sell me on keeping in shape. I guess that's why I've always been sold on Pennzoil protection. Pennzoil helps keep the equipment in shape. And believe me, I'm a guy who believes in taking care of the old equipment.
So what made Arnold Palmer a successful sports celebrity?
Well, again, this goes to his personality. People just, he was so magnetic. People were just drawn to him, and he would sell anything. He sold things from Pennzoil to bathrobes to lemonade and iced tea, which, of course, is named after him. And Arnold made a handshake agreement with Mark McCormick that basically founded IMG, the world's largest sports agency. And to that point, there wasn't such a thing as celebrity marketing of athletes. There were huge stars like Babe Ruth, but Arnold Palmer took it to a whole nother level and became a celebrity endorser. And that created an entire industry that grew around it. And today, all these guys who have these massive endorsement contracts, probably owe some residuals to Arnold Palmer for that. And guys have said that over the years. I mean, up till the day he died, he was making $40 million a year being Arnold Palmer. And, it's really hard for an athlete to do that 30 years beyond their competitive days.
Yeah, so since you mentioned the iced tea, here's a clip from Palmer talking about the tea for ESPN. He's talking about an order he gave at a diner, and that eventually became what we know of as the owner Arnold Palmer.
I want an iced tea, but I want about a third or a quarter of it in lemonade. All of a sudden, the waitress went over to another table, and the lady at the table said, "I want an Arnold Palmer." Well, all of us turned our head. We thought, what is she talking about? From that day on, it spread like wildfire.
Now, I worked at a country club when I was getting my master's degree, and at that point, we made Arnold Palmer's half and half, half lemonade and half iced tea. I don't know how you drink it, Scott, but if you want to talk about a change in Augusta, there's almost nobody that goes to the Masters tournament and doesn't drink at least one Arnold Palmer, right?
I'm sure there are many, and he was very specific about how he wanted that ratio of iced tea to lemonade. He didn't like it at his clubs when they made it too much lemonade. He thought that lemonade was supposed to enhance the iced tea and not overwhelm it.
Okay, so then let's get back to something more serious. And I wanted to talk about one thing that many people refer to, at least athletes, when they're talking about Arnold Palmer. And that's the way he encouraged other young athletes. So here he is talking about the future of golf in an interview from last year.
I hear people say golf is falling. I don't think it is. I think it's just pausing right now. And I think that we will see these young people that are coming along will make a great difference in the game of golf in the years to come.
How do other athletes remember Arnold Palmer? What do they say he's done?
Well, I'll tell you that there's not a golfer, male or female, in the world who's won a professional golf tournament that hasn't gotten a handwritten note from Arnold Palmer congratulating for that. He always felt that it is his responsibility to help nurture this class of a new class of golfer in the world, and to teach them how to do things the right way. So, I mean, I think everyone who certainly goes down to play in the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Orlando goes there out of respect for him and what he meant to their careers, bringing them along. He always invited amateurs to participate in his event, just like Augusta National invites amateurs to participate in the Masters, because he felt building the game from the ground up was a very important thing to do. And again, it goes back to being the son of a greenskeeper. You know, he wanted everybody to have a place in golf and to find out whatever golf could bring into their lives. And he's encouraged that throughout his whole life.
So, I mean, as a sports writer, you write about a lot of different athletes. You see the rise and fall of a number of great prospects. You see a very tiny few of them rise to the very top echelons of any athletic field. We've talked a lot about his personality, but was there something else? What separated Arnold Palmer from the rest of the field when he played?
It was his will to win. I mean, nobody could ever question that Arnold Palmer wanted to win an event because of the way he attacked a golf course. He would just lash. That swing of his, it looks almost like a hockey swing sometimes. He would take a huge lash at the golf ball and just take on every pin on the course, whether it ended up in a spectacular shot or a spectacular failure. He went at it the same way every time. And I think that's kind of the thing you see with Phil Mickelson in golf today. But few people, some people tend to be more protective and just try to hold their place and not get too far off the lead, whereas Arnold Palmer always wanted to win, and that was primary. And finishing second didn't matter to more than finishing 10th. So he would always attack the golf course, and people loved watching him play like that because, you know, everybody says he would hitch up his pants and get going, and that's when you knew, here it comes. Here comes Arnold Palmer's charge.
So, I mean, Phil Mickelson is 46 years old, so although he's not old yet, he is among the higher ages of professional golfers at this point. Do you agree with those who've said that Arnold Palmer represents an era in golf which is over, which is sort of aging out of the sport?
Well, I hope not. I hope his era isn't gone. I mean, I know sports has changed and celebrity has changed and you know, people can't get as close to their sporting heroes as they did in the day when Arnold reigned as the king. But I would hope that you know, what he brought to the game would still stand up forever, and people would always aspire to try to represent themselves and represent their sport in the same way that Arnold Palmer did.
So, Scott Michaud, you've written for the Augusta Chronicle for how long?
I've been there since 2001.
Okay, so a good long time. What does the loss of Arnold Palmer mean to Augusta, not his hometown, and not a place where he's played golf in a very long time?
Well, it'll be a heartbreaking moment on Thursday morning of the Masters in April when we all go to the first tee to see Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player tee off without Arnold Palmer. He didn't hit a tee shot last year, but he was there, and people just showed up to see him. For years, that's what we've been doing. We've always liked following him around the golf course just to see him hitting the ball. It didn't matter if he shot 89. We wanted to see Arnold Palmer in the flesh and be there. So it's going to be a massive loss when we all show up in April and he's not at the Champions Dinner and he's not wearing a green jacket and standing under the tree and talking to people and holding court. It's not going to feel like the Masters in some ways next year without him there.
We got this tweet from Terry Anulowitz, who, again, I'm probably masquerading her name, but says, fun fact, Chick-fil-A has an off-menu drink called Skinny Palmer. It's half unsweet tea, half diet lemonade, and it is thumbs up. Scott, do you drink Arnold Palmer's?
I have had Arnold Palmer's, and I went to Latrobe Country Club during the U.S. Open this year at Oakmont and had what you call a hard Arnie there. And that was Arnie's favorite in the later years, where you put a little Kettle One in it as well. So,
Kettle One vodka?
Vodka. That would be known as a hard Arnie. So yeah, I love a good Arnold Palmer. I get it in a can, or you just make it by yourself.
And what would you think would be the best way for Augusta and the Masters to memorialize Arnold Palmer? Have you thought about that?
Well, they've memorialized him in so many different ways already. There's a water fountain on site, and I think Arnold Palmer's legacy will stand up, but I know it's going to be a special and very emotional scene when Chairman Billy Payne gets up and says something to say goodbye in some way to Arnold Palmer on Thursday morning when the Masters starts. They're not going to put any statues, and they don't have any other structures to name right now for him.
Yeah.
But Arnold Palmer's legacy will always be around Augusta.
That is Scott Michaud, sports writer for the Augusta Chronicle. You'll find a link to Scott's article about Palmer at gppnews.org. Scott, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Celeste.
A public memorial for Palmer will be held today in his hometown of Latrobe, Pennsylvania. He was 87 years old. That's our show for today, but I wonder if you think there is an athlete that was transformative. What athlete do you think had an outsized impact on our society or our culture, and why? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can go to Facebook and post there. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.